John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And an assessment of the work environment for VA Secretary Eric Shinseki right now, who some in Congress want to fire, and the American Legion has asked to resign.
This is the general with the utmost integrity. So I think the right question to ask is, why does General Shinseki, with impeccable integrity and care for our veterans, why is this person having difficulty changing the system? That is the right question to ask. I think it's an incredibly wrong question to ask whether General Shinseki should step down or not. I think Congress must step up.
We'll take a look at the hostile work environment for those who bring problems to light at the Veterans Administration. Also, the hostility for low-wage workers when employers skim their pay with impunity. Also, thoughts about the landslide victory of the BJP in India. A new political epoch begins in the world's largest democracy. Narendra Modi, is he a leader up to the task of India's challenges in the 21st century? A global leader in the mold of Nehru or the Gandhis? More later this hour. And we'll look back at the epoch that began 60 years ago with the Brown versus Board of Education decision to desegregate public schools. But to begin, has this man presided over a hostile environment for veterans seeking services from the nation they served in uniform?
It's important for me to assure veterans to regain their trust, whatever has been compromised here, that when they come to VA, they come to a good, safe, caring system.
Secretary of Veterans Affairs Eric Shinseki facing Congress over allegations of favoritism and excessive delays in treating veterans at VA medical facilities, including a VA hospital in Phoenix where 40 veterans reportedly died awaiting treatment. Shinseki has refused to resign, even though the American Legion and some in Congress have called for his and other managers' heads to roll in this scandal. Shinseki said he was mad as hell, determined to get to the bottom of the allegations and hold people responsible. It may be too late. Is this a pattern of neglect and lack of accountability? Aaron Glantz, staff reporter at the Center for Investigative Reporting, believes it may be. We have spoken to him a number of times about questionable treatment approaches and the quality of service at the VA. Now he brings us new allegations of service delays for suicide risk patients at a VA facility in St. Louis. What's more, the doctor who came forward to try and correct the problems in St. Louis was sanctioned by his employer, demoted, investigated, and told he was creating a hostile work environment. The doctor is Joes Matthews, a psychiatrist at the VA Medical Center in St. Louis.
You know, I took the position as the chief of psychiatry in November of 2012. And shortly thereafter, I started getting some complaints from veterans about their having difficulty accessing timely care and complaints about people being turned away. So I started to look at how our clinic was functioning. And to my shock, I discovered that I could not account for the majority of time for the psychiatrists. And they were seeing, on average, 6 psychiatrically ill patients in an 8-hour day. And these are psychiatrists, so they're not psychologists offering an hour therapy. The vast majority of these appointments are 30-minute appointments. So I could not account for more than, 3.5 hours out of 8 hours as direct patient care related. So in essence, we are functioning as if we were only open for half of the business time that we're supposed to be providing care for.
Now, at the same time that you were discovering that only 3.5 hours could be associated with actual patient care, as far as you could tell, what kinds of delays were being experienced by veterans coming to the clinic?
Yes. So the delays that were being experienced was, was a lot. And these are mentally ill patients with serious mental illnesses. And this was causing an acceptable delay, in my opinion. The first appointment delay was 3 weeks or more. And for a follow-up appointment, it was 30 days or more. You know, Missouri, unfortunately, has one of the highest percentages of veterans amongst the people who commit suicide. And veterans would come in sometimes. And like I said, they were sent away. So the first policy decision I made was that no veteran will be turned away, that every veteran who comes, whether someone calls in sick, will need to be seen.
I don't understand how that disconnect could have happened. You've got the highest suicide rate, or one of the highest suicide rates among veterans in the state of Missouri. So that indicates that there's a real public health urgency here. And yet the clinic was half open. I mean, it was doing half days. How can that possibly be? Plus, you've got the delays of people who are possible suicide candidates having to go home for 3 weeks.
And this was the biggest shock, because the VA data of productivity would tell me that we are not only performing fine, but we are amongst the top performers in the VA nationwide for mental health. And this was just not true from when I look at what was actually happening. For instance, how many patients were being seen. What's the delay for a patient for the first appointment, for the follow-up appointment? And how many of the patients that we see are retained in care? I mean, I found that 60% of the patients were dropping out of care. They were not seeing their outpatient provider for, you know, more than 3 appointments in 1 year. Now, that level of attrition or people opting out of care, it leads to a very unsafe situation.
Aaron Glantz, as you step back and look at the system and evaluate it in the context of what Secretary Shinseki is having to deal with on Capitol Hill, is this part of the same problem, or is St. Louis an outlier on some level?
What Dr. Matthews is talking about is a fundamental lack of accountability at VA, where doctors and psychiatrists and schedulers and pretty much everyone, hospital directors, are allowed to underperform, to do things that can result in the deaths of patients, and cover them up, pretend they never happened, and move on. And when somebody like Dr. Matthews comes forward, they often get punished, as he was demoted from being the chief of psychiatry when he came forward and given a new office in the basement where he no longer is part of the, you know, regular psychiatric practice of the VA in St. Louis. On Capitol Hill, during the hearing, senators grilled Secretary Shinseki about the fact that this is a problem of longstanding. We saw inspector generals' reports in 2005, 2007, and 2012 about some of these very issues. There are past congressional hearings. Now it's erupted in a national scandal. Shinseki told the lawmakers that he's on top of it, that they're going to do audits of all the hospitals and clinics. The question that came back from Congress is, you told us this before. What's different now? Why should we believe you this time?
Dr. Matthews, what was the event that caused you to really come forward and go public with this after really getting pushback from every level within the VA?
What really made me come forward was if I leave, you know, I don't know who would stand up and expose this and make sure that the veterans' interests are protected. You know, I think I was bullied to just let this slide. In fact, I was cautioned many times to, quote-unquote, go slow. And in this investigation that I'm, you know, they started an administrative investigation against me, and one of the absurd questions to me was what I would do differently. And again, I don't know what the accusations are or how I've created a hostile work environment is the technical term they've used, because in my mind, I was trying to create a work environment. The hostility was towards the veterans. Their interests were not protected. And so I had to tell them that, look, you know, I have no idea what I would do differently, because this is exactly what I would do and what any other person in my position should be expected to do, which is to advocate as strongly as possible for the veterans' interest. My interest was not in protecting status quo that was unethical or comfortable for the staff. I mean, that was just not acceptable to me.
So I want to read you the response from the St. Louis Veterans Administration. And this is a statement that was given to some of your people, Aaron. We take these allegations seriously. The St. Louis VA Medical Center leadership is aware of and is addressing the alleged issues. VA is committed to providing the best quality of care that all our nation's veterans need and deserve. Now, what does that statement say to you, Aaron?
It's pretty typical for the VA. This is not happening, but if it were happening, we're on top of it. right? And we actually heard the same thing on Capitol Hill where, you know, senators were reviewing some of the internal emails and documents that have come out about the fixing of appointment schedules all over the country, making it seem like veterans were getting timely appointments when they actually weren't. And Dr. Matthews is making, you know, similar allegations about the fixing of productivity numbers for psychiatrists. And Secretary Shinseki and the Undersecretary for Health, Dr. Robert Petzl, both said that all of these things were unacceptable, that they were on top of it. And then they were asked, well, can you give us an example in the past where something like this happened and somebody was fired or disciplined? And they were unable to do it. And this is what makes people so angry, is that, you know, when somebody like Dr. Matthews comes forward and makes allegations of wrongdoing that's impacting the quality of care that our veterans receive, he's punished. But the people who are the source of the problem are allowed to continue and oftentimes promoted and receive large bonuses. And when you look at the statement that was given by the VA in St. Louis to Dr. Matthews' allegations, it doesn't really inspire confidence.
And as Aaron said, the unaccountability is something that really bothers me, because this is done with impunity. You know, there is not even any, you know, attempt to hide it. You know, it's like, this is how we do business. In fact, there were many people who, to my face, told me that this is the VA. This is not the university setting. You know, this is how we do things. This has gone far beyond just, you know, not having information, hence we made a mistake. I think this is having information but lacking the courage and the will to protect those who underwrite our freedoms, and that should not be excusable.
Do you think General Shinseki should go?
Well, you know, first of all, I have to say that I have the utmost respect for General Shinseki, because he may not be, you know, classified as a whistleblower, but when we were preparing to invade Iraq, he had the courage and he had the integrity to stand up to Congress and tell the truth that we needed much, much larger troop to invade a country and secure the peace. Not win the war, but secure the peace. So this is the general with the utmost integrity. So I think the right question to ask is, why does General Shinseki, with impeccable integrity and care for our veterans, why is this person having difficulty changing the system? That is the right question to ask. I think it's an incredibly wrong question to ask whether General Shinseki should step down or not. I think Congress must step up.
The question that I wonder is, why does it take a national scandal and intense congressional scrutiny to get the VA to do what they know they should have done all along? And every time this sort of dynamic repeats itself, members of Congress and veterans groups get more and more frustrated. And I think a lot of people are wondering why, if General Shinseki is a man, as Dr. Matthews says, of impeccable integrity, how it could be that he could allow all of these crises to fester for so long.
Aaron Glantz, staff reporter at the Center for Investigative Reporting, and Joes Matthews, a doctor, a psychiatrist at the St. Louis VA Medical Center. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here are some questions now that speak to a living legacy in American education. What do you think segregated schools were like in pre-1954 America? In what parts of the country were schools segregated? What is segregation? Does it still exist? The Supreme Court decision has come to be known in shorthand form as Brown v. Board of Education, but that one name represents several cases. What other cities and states were involved in court battles to end public school segregation? These are discussion questions for a seventh grade unit of social studies. 60 years ago, the adults asking these questions were lawyers, arguing before the U.S. Supreme Court. The case declared that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. Brown v. Board of Ed changed education, but it is also a part of the American history taught in the classrooms desegregated by the very decision. Joining us is Joy DePalm, a sixth-grade language arts and social studies teacher at the Boston Teachers Union School in Boston, Mass. Joy, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us is Beth Berkey, a seventh grade language arts teacher at James Martin Middle School in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Beth.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So, Joy, let me begin with you. What's it like to have students in your class grappling with and asking the very same questions that Thurgood Marshall put to the Supreme Court in the Brown v. Board of Ed decision?
This is really a coincidence. I'm actually starting a unit where we'll be looking at Brown v. the Board of Ed, as well as Plessy versus Ferguson. A lot of students don't understand what racism is, what prejudice is, and the difference between the two. And so there are a lot of questions. There are a lot of unknowns. One of the misconceptions about race and racism is that race is a human construct, and that racism is systemic, and that I myself, as an African-American teacher, because of my educational background, I too am capable of perpetuating racism in a system if I'm not aware of it. So my main goal is to make them aware that it is systemic, that it's not a one-on-one interaction, that that's different.
All right. So a lot of learning to do there in your class. Beth Berkey, what's it like for you to see the kids grappling with these same issues in a school classroom?
I see a lot of the same things that Joy sees. A lot of the students don't understand what racism really is, and they definitely use the term in a way that it shouldn't be used. You know, if somebody calls somebody else by their race, they think that that person is being racist. The other thing is that students don't realize that this only happened 50 years ago. They think that it happened, you know, a very, very, very long time ago because they don't have the conception of the time yet.
So, Beth Berkey, it sounds like it's really a challenge to deal with this on a psychological level, that in some ways the historical details are the easy part.
That is very true. And the students, they do try to understand that this, you know, didn't happen that long ago. But we had a good conversation this year. I did a whole unit on diversity and racism and prejudice, and they do feel like it's still an issue today, and they do feel like they're at a disadvantage. So it's interesting for me, especially as a Caucasian teacher, to stand up in the front of the room in a whole class that's filled with African-American and Hispanic children and hear them kind of open up about that. But they definitely do still feel like they're at a disadvantage today.
For both of you, what is the shadow of segregation in 2014? Beth, let's begin with you.
Sure. So the school that I teach at is definitely still somewhat segregated. It is about 70% African-American and then 25% Hispanic. So there's a little bit of diversity there, but not much. And it really does have an effect on the kids because they are so unaware of what else is out there in the world. And there's so much less that they've experienced that a lot of kids that live in other parts of the country do get to experience. So it's definitely still apparent today. When my school first opened, they used to bus the students so that it was very diverse. But because of funding, they had to stop doing that.
So, Beth, has a student ever raised his or her hand and said, why are we so segregated here? I thought Brown versus Board of Education was supposed to get rid of this.
Not in those exact terms, but they have brought up the fact that they do feel like going to school where they do, they don't have the same opportunities as other students. So we have to do our best as teachers to hold them to those high expectations so that they don't feel that way and that they don't think that way.
Joy, what's the shadow of segregation in your classroom as you can see it?
On paper, the school building seems diverse, but certain parts of the building have more Black and Brown faces than others. My students, it's not until they step out of the school that they realize that there's something different. We've had students who have gone into a program called METGO, where they attend school in the suburbs, and the disparity in the funding at these schools, it's like amazing. It's like, you know, oh, Mr. Palm, I went to this high school and they have a music studio and an art studio. And why don't we have that in Boston? And I'm kind of at a loss because I have several answers as to why that's happening. And equity and access is one of them.
So it sounds like you need to do a unit on economics and class in America, right?
Yes, I'm a busy person. So at some point it'll happen. But it's a multifaceted issue. What do you do with this information once you get it, once you know that in some cases the cards are stacked against you? It's not a pass to give up. And so my goal is to create a space, a safe space for students to create that counter narrative that says, okay, you don't want to give us funding. You want to keep us, you know, separated within a building that looks integrated. This is what I want to be. And these are the people who are going to support me and my aspirations.
How are your challenges in the classroom, Joy, different than being a mom?
They are not that different. I have a five-year-old, young Black boy. I think he is a genius, and I feel the same way about him that I do about my students. So a lot of times when I'm faced with dilemma on how far should I go for my students, I always think about what I want someone to do for my son. Would I want them to put limitations and tell him that he can't do something or he can't be something, or would I want to guide them through the steps and let them make the decision on their own?
You know, I'm hearing from both of you, and Beth, maybe you could answer this before we go. I'm hearing from both of you that there's really a lot to be done 60 years after Brown v. Board of Education, and that the kids in your classroom, Beth, are very conscious of the economic disparities that are such a huge political issue right now in America.
They are very aware. Something that was really heartbreaking for me this year was during our unit on diversity, I had a student actually say that Hispanic and African American kids can't do anything else besides become drug dealers. And to hear that was really shocking, to really know that they actually think that way. So through the lessons that I did, I really tried to teach that they can't let those things stand in their way.
Joy, does that sound familiar to you?
Somewhere in society, this message is being sent to our children that children of color are inferior in terms of their intellectual ability. And so that's a battle. I mean, if they're finding this out at 2 and I'm getting them at 11 and 12, that's, you know, over a decade of damage that has been done that, you know, I have to start to chip away at.
The challenges in the classroom 60 years after Brown v. Board of Education. Beth Berkey and Joy DePalm, thanks so much for sharing those stories with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Previously, we had been told that if we went to white schools, that they were smarter, that they were bigger, better, and faster. It was then that I found out that there were smart people and there were dumb people on both races. And so that to me was, you know, something that I really discovered.
A memory of what it was like when desegregation came to the public schools of Miami in the 1960s. Reatha Boumfai was in eighth grade when she became one of just a few Black students at Miami Jackson Senior High.
You could tell the ones that really did not want us there. In fact, some of them transferred out.
Every week we were used to having anywhere from 3 or 4 bomb threats. The siren go off, the fire department come.
In 1963, Mamie Pinder there was a first-time classroom teacher responding to those threats in her integrated fourth-grade class at the once all-white Alapata Elementary School. Those memories are part of what happened in the years following the Brown v. Board of Education decision that desegregated public education in the United States 60 years ago. They come to us from our friends at WLRN in South Florida. So we ask you, what is the shadow of segregation in the classrooms of your community? What divides kids today?
Hi, my name is Jessica Baker, and I am a teacher from South Carolina, and I feel one of the greatest challenges that continues to divide American classrooms is parental involvement. From taking kids to museums or parks and talking about what they're studying in school to simply demonstrating a belief in the value of education, parents are rarely found to be a happy medium.
Thanks for that, Jessica. Bradenton, Florida writes, socioeconomic divides are a huge problem that show up in districts and schools and even within a class. Unfortunately, these socioeconomic differences tend to correlate with racial differences. Schools are still highly segregated, often coincidentally with racial divides, because socioeconomic status often dictates student performance and preference. Karen from Orlando, Florida agrees.
My son will graduate in June from one of the top public schools in the county. Our federal graduation rate at his high school is 93%. And the weakest school in the county graduates 74% of its students, and the difference is poverty. One school serves 28% of its students free lunch, and the other serves 85%. So when we look for why our classrooms continue to divide, all we need to do is follow the money.
One division in today's classrooms is the blurry line between special education and mainstream students. I've seen regulatory issues or just a simple lack of resources leave students with a wide range of disabilities lumped together with others who might not learn in a similar way or at a similar pace. There are students with dyslexia or Asperger's sharing classrooms and curriculum with students who have very different needs, such as those with Down syndrome.
Different times, different divisions in the classroom. San Antonio, Texas says it's about the teachers. Inequality in the distribution of resources plagues the system. Good teachers have no incentive to stay in underprivileged areas, not to mention the hair trigger response to cut education funds and budgets when states face fiscal troubles.
I'm Diana from Miami, Florida, and I think the biggest division in schools today is between the kids that make it to top universities and the kids that just drop out of high school at 17 out of frustration with the system that isn't serving them well.
The good America tries to deal with its divisions, racial divisions. 60 years ago, it was Brown v. Board of Education. What was it today? What is it today? Continue sharing your thoughts about the legacy. What continues to divide American classrooms by calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo. Recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube. All on the TiVo Romeo DVR, TiVo.com.
He's as tall as a 30-story building.
Attention, everyone. This is an emergency broadcast.
Got to lure him out into the open so we can get a clear shot at him. Over.
No problem, man.
Now he's making his way toward the city's main line of defense.
They're not fooling anybody.
Make sure the damn thing doesn't leave the island.
It's for dinner!
Godzilla stalks the world here on this Friday with our Movie Date podcast team, Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer. Rafer is the film critic for Newsday. Kristen Meinzer, the producer for the Sporkful podcast. Welcome, guys.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
And we're shaking in our boots with the arrival of Godzilla here, right?
The coffee cups are shaking right now on our desks.
This is the second or third 21st century Godzilla, I believe. The tiny little Godzilla versions early in the century, but this is the first big
treatment. Big one. The last one was 98 with Matthew Broderick, as I recall.
Let's have a clip.
I'll meet them down there myself. Put the safety doors on manual override.
Joe, I cannot do that.
Keep the doors open. My wife is still in there.
Scary Godzilla. Nothing to laugh about here, Kristen, eh?
Oh, that's wonderful. Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad dealing with the truth. Nobody wants to believe him, but there is something out there. It is Godzilla. And this time around, Godzilla's not a man in a suit. He's enormous. He's the size of a city. There's even been criticism from Japan that maybe he's a little bit too obese, that maybe Godzilla shouldn't be so fat. But
originally, Godzilla was all about a whale meets a gorilla. It's like a gorilla whale. So there, you'd expect some blubber there. That was the original idea.
Well, originally he was sort of a metaphor for Nagasaki, for Hiroshima, for the Bikini Atoll. He had kind of dark thematic roots. This Godzilla has no personality to me. I maybe prefer the old guys in the foam rubber suits, but this Godzilla, he doesn't come across as a character to me.
How about this, the immigrant?
Sir, can you help me?
Ma'am, you were in the exclusion line. Did they explain to you what that meant?
Yes.
They're sending you back.
They're sending you back, evokes the fears of immigrants. Small release, but big cast. What do you say, Rafer?
Yeah, that's Joaquin Phoenix playing a guy who you might call sort of a predator on the new immigrants to Ellis Island, and Marion Cotillard plays one of them. It's great acting. Terrific cast. Jeremy Renner is also in this movie. Essentially kind of a love triangle. Beautifully shot, handsome. I found it a little overwrought, a little sudsy in kind of a soap opera way.
I'm guessing Kristen loved this.
I thought the acting was fantastic. I thought it was beautiful to look at, but I actually found it a little bit too predictable. Mm. And at points it just felt like torture porn. This is somebody who's going to be tortured and tortured and tortured until the end of the movie by two men.
All right, no more torture. Let's end on a baseball flick.
Lefty with juice. You don't see that every day.
Lefty with juice is good, sir?
Lefty with juice is great. Lefty with juice is money in the bank.
Going to South Asia, to India, to recruit for a baseball team. Does this work? The million-dollar arm.
It's a little bit Mad Men. It's a little bit Cool Runnings. You have John Hamm, famous for being the madman pitch man, who actually opens the movie with a whole pitch about sports and who needs to find a new way to make money. He's kind of a jerk. He's kind of a womanizer. He goes, he recruits some baseball players in India, and maybe they turn his life around. It's not just him turning their lives around, and maybe he's changing the face of baseball all at once. And I have to say it was pretty heartwarming. It's sweet, and maybe I cried a little bit. Sometimes, yeah, I cried.
I found this movie a little bit colonialist. There's a somewhat condescending feel to the two Indian teens who are treated and often called kids. They kind of romp about through the hotels like Curious George and pushing buttons and, you know, triggering fire alarms. And in the end, they kind of have to form sort of a family with JB as the dad. And I found all that just a little condescending. But Kristen's right. It is pretty heartwarming. It's a Disney movie, and it's got that quality. And ultimately, I'd say it works.
Kristen cried.
I did cry.
That's no surprise.
And on the podcast?
We are talking with the producer of Million Dollar Arm, who actually is, his name is Mark Ciardi, and he's also a former professional pitcher with the Milwaukee Brewers, so he brought some real personal insight into the movie.
Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, co-host of the Movie Date podcast and the Sporkful podcast. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks,
you too,
John.
And now some thoughts on the national pastime of India, and it's not the million-dollar arms of baseball. More like this.
In the air, Srishant takes it! India win! Unbelievable scenes here at the ballpark.
That's right, more like this. The pastime I'm thinking of scores numbers approaching Indian World Cup champion cricket. 1 billion people watched the last India versus Pakistan contest. But no, I'm talking about something else. I'm talking about the national pastime of Indian politics. 550 million people in India made it to the polls in the longest and best-financed democratic election in the history of India. It represents a voter turnout of more than 66%, a record for India, and a higher turnout for any democracy in the world where voting isn't compulsory. Only South Africa at 73%, Malaysia at 84%, and Kenya at almost 86% top India's turnout. It's also above the paltry 57.5% turnout in the USA in 2012. But the scale of India's achievement puts it in a class by itself. Since the last election in 2009, India's electorate grew by 100 million, which is a pair of South Africa's or four Australia's. The number of people who didn't go to the polls in India in 2014 just about equals the entire population of the United States, 318 million. To get such an election in the books, you need, first of all, 5 weeks. Then you need 930,000 polling booths, 2 million voting machines, 15,000 liters of indelible ink to mark voters' fingers. By the way, that much ink will fit nicely into a small tanker truck. Couple more numbers here. The losing Indian National Congress Party vote tally is estimated at about double the 65 million people who voted for Barack Obama last time. And the estimated tally for the winning BJP party easily exceeds the total numbers of votes cast for Barack Obama, Mitt Romney, and the also-rans. One more thing. To carry out such an exercise of democracy and to prevent violence and fraud, you hire 11 million poll workers, 8 million of whom are security guards, which, by the way, is about the population of New York City. No, that's not cricket. It's politics, Indian style and Indian scale. And it goes today by the name of the new Indian leader from the BJP, Narendra Modi. Joining me now from the ground in New Delhi is Ellen Berry, New York Times India Bureau Chief. Welcome, Ellen.
Thank you.
Narendra Modi called this a victory for India today. Is it?
Certainly, this was a vast election. It went off mostly without violence. And I think you can say today that a very clear message was sent by the population.
Is he a unifying force within India? And is he the kind of leader who will really be on the global stage as well as being a politician within India?
He's a very different kind of leader than India has had for the last decade, that's for sure. He's a conservative nationalist, comes out of a Hindu nationalist movement, basically, and has certainly turned away from the kind of welfare-based leftist politics of the Indian National Congress, which has ruled India for almost all of its post-independence history.
Would you say there's a market orientation for Modi, and what would that consist of in emerging India's economy?
He certainly has a lot of supporters and advisors who hope that he will be the Margaret Thatcher of India. the more complicated side and the controversial side of his history is that very early on, when he first took over the state, he was the leader of Gujarat during the worst religious riots to occur since independence. About 1,000 people were killed, and many people, particularly Muslims, but others as well, believe that he didn't take the steps that he could have to stop the violence. So that shadow has really followed him up until this day. But I think the message of this vote is that that history didn't matter to Indians. They viewed him as a development man, as a good governance person who would rebuild the economy, and that overwhelmed all other considerations.
That shadow that followed him, it is very interesting that it doesn't cast him at all as a sectarian leader. There's really an absence of that kind of language, both in this campaign and from the rhetoric from the BJP these days.
For the most part, absolutely, he avoided making any openly divisive comments, and he has generally done so during the 12 years since the riots. But Mr. Modi has certainly chosen the markets and development as his persona, and that has been accepted by almost all of the voters that I interacted with.
Two things before we go. Number one, this really pushes the fringe parties that are used to being kingmakers in India way into the background. And any sense of Modi's relationships with other regional leaders and members of the G7 even?
This is a remarkable win for Modi. I don't think practically anyone expected him to do as well as he's done, particularly the Indian National Congress, which knew that they were headed for a loss and with some equanimity were preparing to be in the opposition. But this is an overwhelming landslide when it looks like the BJP is going to have enough seats to form a government independently without any coalition partners. That means the regional heavyweights are out of luck, even though a couple of them did very well. They're used to having an enormous amount of leverage over the central government, and that won't be true.
And what about Modi's relationship with other leaders in the region and among the G7 countries?
Modi has certainly projected the intention to make India into a strong, respected regional power. You hear a great deal about returning India to its past glory. He has generally turned east. All of his early travels were east to South Asia, and he is said to have been very powerfully impressed by the national models in South Asia. He is clearly very impressed with Chinese and the Chinese scale mega projects because he has emulated that style in Gujarat. And because he faced so much opprobrium from the West over the Gujarat riots, I think there is a lot of baggage that will have to be worked out between him and the Western market democracies. However, as a relatively pragmatic leader who has really staked his success on economic growth, I think he's going to be thinking of investment first and foremost. So a will and probably a way to rebuild those relationships.
On the line from Delhi, Ellen Berry is the South Asia Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Another detail from India's political culture, the victory celebrations will toast with cups of water and tea. Indian election laws ban alcohol sales, impose curfews on nightclubs and bars, and require licensed gun owners to deposit their weapons with police or gun dealers for the entire polling and counting period. Something we might try here in the USA?
Listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
There are few options for low-wage workers to advance themselves in the U.S. economy. Typically, this is how minimum wage workers ask their employers for a raise.
No justice!
No work!
Demonstrate like these fast food workers in Philadelphia yesterday, part of a nationwide effort to organize vulnerable service workers and get better pay.
They don't offer us any benefits and they want us, you know, to work long hours without breaks and it's just not enough.
Not even close to enough for Subway sandwich shop employee Justice Wallace there. The minimum wage is slowly rising in communities around the nation. Seattle may soon become the first community with a minimum wage of $15 an hour. But will employers comply? Have they even complied with current wage mandates? Low-wage warehouse workers in California this week won a case for $21 million in back pay brought against a contractor for Walmart. Skimming the wages of low-wage workers or simply not paying for hours worked is not hard to get away with. Construction, garment manufacturing, restaurants, and home health care workers are often immigrants and find themselves vulnerable to bullying by their employer. Myron Levin is the founder and editor of an investigative news site, Fair Warning. He says low-wage workers fear reporting wage theft, which means employers are tempted to reap all kinds of economic benefits.
If you're not paying even the minimum wage, such as it is now, you save money. Overtime violations are rampant. They're supposed to receive a time and a half after 40 hours in a week. And in certain industries, that's just very widely ignored. Then certain kinds of violations occur because of misclassifying workers as independent contractors. And if you do that and get away with it, you save on Medicare and Social Security, unemployment taxes, and workers' compensation premiums.
And what about appealing to the wage and hour division at the Department of Labor? There's a federal institution designed to possibly correct some of these abuses.
Well, they do enforcement for certain. And, you know, by their records, they've put about $1 billion in back wages back in the pockets of workers who were underpaid over the last 5 years or so. But they really don't have enough investigators to police this as effectively as they might. The number of investigators they have fell to a very low ebb under the Bush administration. They've ramped up their hiring, their staffing somewhat under Obama, but they still have fewer investigators than they did in the late 1970s when, you know, the size of the workforce was much smaller and the number of establishments to be monitored was much smaller.
I was surprised to learn that the garment industry may have a 93% rate of wage theft, and some of the garment employers are pretty ingenious in the ways they falsify their payroll.
Yes. In one case, they found that a string of these garment shops were using a kind of software that falsified, automatically converted underpaid wages, really, into an appearance of compliance by taking piecework rates that fell below minimum wage and didn't provide overtime for these employees who worked very, very long weeks. And converted them to a fictional record of compliance with minimum wage and overtime rules.
How do workers, go about getting back wages, paid to them if they find themselves in this situation?
Well, they complain, to authorities, to the Wage and Hour Division, or if they're in a state that actually tries to enforce these laws, complain to them. I mean, one of the things is it is very much a complaint-driven system. And you have a population of workers that are low-skilled in many instances, that are immigrants and that are undocumented in many cases, and they're afraid that the only thing that will happen if they file a complaint is that they'll be fired or reported to immigration. And one thing that we encountered is a number of instances where this is exactly what happened when employees complained. They were threatened with being turned over to immigration, or an investigation commenced and employers wanted the workers to lie to investigators and were coaching them to lie about the pay practices of the company and hinted or outright threatened that they would call immigration on them.
Now, some of the legal remedies here include wage lien laws, which some states have adopted. Can you describe how that works? I mean, it seems very draconian, but in some ways it's probably the only recourse that workers would have.
Yes, these laws exist in, I think it's 8 states now, and they're being considered by other states. What it would do is it would say that if you have a claim, you can file the claim on the assets of the employer. Because these cases, if you do report them, take a long time to work their way through the system, sometimes months or even years. for you to get a hearing on a complaint, and therefore by the time you win, the company is out of business, or they're under new ownership, they're bankrupt, they've disappeared, and there's no way for you to collect. You hold a piece of paper saying you won, and that's it. So the wage lien laws are designed to address that.
And I suspect all of this means that there's plenty of opportunity for you to do reporting on your investigative news site, Fair Warning. I mean, this is a wide open domain.
Yes, I think it is. And you know, particularly now, there's, you know, a lot of discussion of raising the minimum wage. And sometimes lost in that conversation is that many workers aren't getting the minimum wage that exists now, such as it is, through various means. One thing that we found a number of examples of is that workers will get a daily rate. You know, you're paid $50 a day for a certain job. There's nothing illegal about that, but if the number of hours you're expected to work average out to something under the federal minimum wage or the state minimum wage, that's a violation of the law, and that occurs fairly frequently, it appears.
Myron Levin is editor and founder of Fair Warning, a Los Angeles-based investigative news site. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Struggles of workers at the bottom and the struggles of students facing low expectations.
During our unit on diversity, I had a student actually say that Hispanic and African-American kids can't do anything else besides become drug dealers. And to hear that was really shocking, to really know that they actually think that way. So through the lessons that I did, I really tried to teach that they can't let those things stand in their way.
That's Beth Berkey, a 7th grade language arts teacher at James Martin Middle School in Charlotte, North Carolina, about what segregation means 60 years after the Brown v. Board of Education decision. Your thoughts? Brooklyn, New York, rich-poor integration still needs to happen. The segregation in U.S. schools is now socioeconomic more than racial. And Portland, Oregon, the challenges in classroom are the home life of students and the content they listen to on the radio, television, and internet. Well, there's an interesting thought. Different division 60 years after Brown v. Board of Ed. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, you can check us out at thetakeaway.org, where the conversation is always going on. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. We'll see you right back here on Monday. This is The Takeaway.
For The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.